We're going to get through this whole podcast without mentioning artificial intelligence. I try to hide from this stuff because, like, I don't want everything I do to be disrupted just yet. I'm having such a good time teaching.
Welcome back to Insights by Design, Episode 3. These are our 2024 predictions. Michael, how are you?
I'm good. Since we last talked, Andrew, how are things over on your end of stuff?
Awesome. Super busy, getting ready for year end, trying to wrap a bunch of projects up so that we can have a nice, quiet end of the year and then hit it hard again in January.
There's no such thing as a quiet end of the year when you work in academia.
What's it like for faculty?
Oh, you're thinking about your next projects, your next classes. I mean, you come out to eat some Christmas turkey and stuff, but I think for a lot of faculty members, it's a very tenuous and sometimes a very tense break. But summers tend to be a little bit more relaxed, but it can be a quick turnaround between semesters.
Are you looking at everything like, can I write a paper about that? Can I write a paper about that? Can I get a grant for this? Like turkey dinner, what are the implications of that where I can write a paper?
I got a big deadline coming in the spring, so I will be writing head down and then hitting teaching really hard with two classes that I've never taught before. But I like teaching new classes and meeting new students and just learning new stuff. So at least the beginning of 2024 should be okay on the faculty side of things for me.
I'm with you. It keeps you sharp. I teach a bunch of programming courses at different universities at the graduate level. And every once in a while, they'll throw me a course in a language that I haven't professionally coded in a few years. And I'm like, oh, shoot.
We said language is not Spanish. Check. Teach this class on Russian.
Yeah, often it's R, or some specific version of SQL, which has different syntax and rules. And I got to button that up because I'm teaching a grad course on it. But it keeps your mind sharp. Then you're all learning at the same time. It's a great experience.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Wonderful. Well, we've got a few different categories for our predictions. We've been thinking a lot about what 2024 brings. A person's been doing my product roadmaps and working with different clients on what do they want to do in 2024, 2025. So it's an excellent time to do our predictions of what does 2024 look like. So the different categories, we're going to talk a little bit about UX, data, of course, our specialties, the overlap between UX and data to drive business value and outcomes, the technology, a lot of exciting technology coming out, and determining what's actually a feature and what's a bug. Regulations, globally, a lot happening there. And then just general trends and predictions of things we've seen, trends we've heard about, listening in to our colleagues. There's a lot going on. Michael, let's kick it off with UX. What are your thoughts on what UX is gonna look like in 2024?
Well, first of all, I should say that I am not Jakob Nielsen, who tracks UX trends way over time and issues these amazing reports. So if anyone wants a deep dive, check out Jakob Nielsen of the Nielsen Norman Group on LinkedIn. But let me share just a few things that I've noticed with UX, with the caveat that UX can be kind of tricky to track because a lot of UX job functions are buried in a variety of job titles. Like you're not necessarily called a UX designer or a UX researcher or a UX generalist. Sometimes you're called a product designer that does the exact same things as a UX designer does, for instance. But one thing I'm noticing is that UX is becoming better integrated into a greater variety of industries. And as it continues to integrate, I think there's gonna be more specialization, and not just a specialization of UX roles, but a specialization of UX industries. I can totally imagine in 2024, there being a job like clinical UX specialist. And the jobs are already out there, but I imagine these growing quite a bit. The Mayo Clinic, for instance, has opened up a whole center for digital health where UX designers and researchers get together and design new stuff, like new electronic health records, new teledoc experiences, and other digital products to promote health and wellness throughout the Mayo Clinic's different sites and different patient populations. But healthcare is not the only area where I'm seeing quite a bit of growth. I'm seeing, I think, a growing number of UX jobs in finance and in insurance. And maybe those jobs have been there for a long time, but I think that the financial industry in particular is tired of being so inscrutable to so many people. And because the stakes are so high, they want all of their digital products, I think, to be better than ever before. And so I can totally imagine there being a UX specialty specific in finance, as well as in related terms where industries are growing, such as agribusiness and things like that. And I'm starting to get a little confused about where the boundaries of user experience and experience design start and end. So while I think UX will always be focusing on some very fundamental things like ease of use and first impressions and those things that really drive clicks and throughput and hopefully conversions, I think that there's also going to be more jobs interested in experiences in general, which could include not just digital spaces, but physical spaces. I've seen jobs where you go up to Minnesota and improve the visitor experiences in their parks. And so I think that UX and experience design are going to continue to merge and shape each other in some very creative and interesting ways. And the boundaries between them are not super clear to me to begin with, although UX tends to have more of a genealogy within usability and the rise of personal computers and things like that. But I think that the demand for having good digital and analog experiences and the shades in between them is going to become more and more pressing as UX becomes more integrated across industries. And so sometimes people think, with the tech downturn, is UX dead? The answer is a resounding no. UX is alive, it is well, and is going to continue to spread and diversify.
That's a great point about the analog experiences. I think COVID put a little bit of reset on the physical experiences that a lot of companies were having, whether it be bank branches, stores, and then they were able to really quickly adapt their digital experience for the folks staying at home, which created a lot of UX strategy and innovation. But now that folks are out and about, and we've seen a lot of data that folks are spending more money than ever out in the real world, not online, I'll bet that the analog in-person experiences are becoming more and more important as a differentiator for companies.
Mm-hmm. And people are building cities nowadays to really blend the digital and the analog together. One of my favorite projects was going over to South Korea and trying to figure out the user experience of a city of the future called Songdo. And on the surface, Songdo is supposed to be an eco city, a smart city, but on the back end, it's a petri dish to really examine how people interact with the Internet of Things. Like, how does it change the whole living experience when you can talk to your toaster, or when you're in constant surveillance when you walk down the street, or when your kid shouts in the park, and then like hundreds of digital eyes suddenly zoop, start trolling to see where the shout came from, is it an emergency, and things like that. And so I think as our city building changes, as our ways of living change, then UX and experience design will continue to adapt with it. And really the boundary between digital and analog is pretty fake anyway. Most of us live in the interstices in between.
We see that a lot with like Amazon Go. They've opened up several more stores where you just go in, you grab your stuff and you leave, right? That's a great experience. I love it. You feel like you're stealing, but you're not. So it gets your adrenaline up, but it's an excellent overlap between the digital and the analog design elements. A great example for innovation, but also for others to emulate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. That's what I see coming down the pike for UX. And so students, new designers, new researchers, hope is not lost. Hang in there. The industry will continue to upturn, but maybe diversify your portfolios with additional projects and additional areas. Stop redesigning the Starbucks mobile app. I've seen that project done dozens of times. Do something with finance, do something with agribusiness, do something with healthcare, and that'll give you a step up as those industries continue to mature with user experience and experience design. Or, like Andrew and I just mentioned, user experience of city building and construction. You know, explore what opportunities are there as well, because as people continue to build, I think UX and user experience will continue to evolve with them.
One a few UX trends that I've been seeing. One is motion graphics and scrolling, especially on like mobile first experiences. Have you seen motion graphics and mobile first scrolling experiences on your end being a trend, or is that just my isolated bias?
I'm actually seeing a move away from mobile-first design in general because a lot of designers find that yes, it simplifies things, but also it simplifies things sometimes way too much. And I think that, I don't know, people, especially as users for these different products become more accustomed to them and become even more technologically savvy, I think people want and sometimes expect more complex digital products. So I think mobile-first design, maybe it's entrenched in some companies, but I think in general, mobile-first design has sort of had its heyday and is on the way out. Not completely out, but definitely on the downslope.
What about things like soft UI, neuromorphism, as you academics call it?
Oh gosh. Remind me what that even is. I remember I had to study that a little while ago, but it didn't take.
It's really a combination of skeuomorphism and flat design. It kind of uses shadows and highlights to make design elements look kind of layered on a page. And its goal is to try to make something look abstract and different while keeping the aesthetic consistent throughout the product. So I've seen some dated websites, for instance, starting to go towards more soft UI. But again, I'm not plugged in to the UI universe as much as you are, so this may just be my biased experience.
Maybe, and I don't know if I'm super plugged into UI specifically. A lot of UX designers feel that, oh, like talking about UI is sort of like talking like the grandpa that you love but didn't really get to know. It's like, well, that's where we came from, but I've never been super deep into the literature on UI, but companies are such diverse spaces and different countries tend to have different design preferences as well. I mean, the general trends of good user experience tend to obtain across national boundaries, but I don't know. And I think it comes down to branding too. If a company really likes the aesthetic of skeuomorphism, then why not? But I don't know. Companies like Airbnb are experimenting with their aesthetic all the time. So it's hard for me to track it or even soft UI as a trend.
You never know when they're doing an A/B test on you, and you're just seeing something different than everybody else.
Oh,
Well,
and with Airbnb, it's an A, B, C, D, E, F, G test sometimes. Like, let's see which of these seven or eight homepages outperform the others. They are really aggressive with their user experience, but I think it shows, and I wish that more companies would value UX as much as Airbnb, because they're really a company success story in a lot of ways. Good product, good user experience. They're not going anywhere in 2024 either.
In another episode, we should talk about how Airbnb used the Snow White story to really reinvigorate their product, and it really saved Airbnb. Really visionary with implementing storyboarding into their process.
I would
What are
add
some?
Uber to that list potentially as well.
Yeah, we hated
Although
Uber
Uber
here
has a
at
dark side, so maybe for another podcast.
X. Uber does have a dark side. Talk about dark patterns with Uber. What are some trends you'd like to see in UX in 2024?
Some trends in UX. I would like to see UX designers better trained at the outset because traditionally in UX, people found their way there through a variety of different career paths. Architecture, graphic design, computer engineering, nursing, education. I've had students from all of those areas and others, and all of those areas are strengths. But I think that it's getting harder and harder to land that entry-level job. And so I want to see new UX designers and researchers and generalists better trained so that they could potentially start at a mid-level role. Because the competition for those lower roles is getting so hard to get. Once you get your foot in the door, it's easier to start to move around. But in general, I want to see better training. We need, I mean, hopefully this isn't a conflict of interest. I work in the master's and our new undergraduate program in user experience at ASU. We are super full. Our students do a great job at going out and getting jobs, but we need more training programs for UX people. We can't just wait for people to find their way into the field. We should grow designers and researchers longer term, have them ready for jobs by the time they graduate with their master's degree, not their master's degree and then 10 years down the road when they get tired of writing code. So I want to see more professionalization at an earlier stage.
That's a great call out. You know, data scientists especially and data engineers experienced that as well, where most data scientists 10 years ago did not have a data background. Maybe they had a computer science, maybe they had something else, maybe they had computational chemistry, and then they found their way into data science because there weren't academic programs focused on data science. But these days now, you know, getting a data science degree is incredibly common, even data analytics. You no longer have to take the computer science route and then morph it into that, or take math and morph it into that. So instead of finding their way into data science, folks are aiming for it, and then they've got the structured pathway for getting into those roles.
Is there a major professional organization for data analytics? So if someone's just a working professional and they want to learn about the field, or if someone's currently a data analyst and they want to connect with like-minded colleagues or do professional development of some kind, are there big organizations out there to represent those people, that job, that skill set?
There's the International Institute of Analytics, but I don't think they're as influential as they'd like to be. There's also the Visualization Society. In my opinion, not as influential. It's mostly for-profit companies who do training, like DataCamp, Coursera, those type of things, where they're really driving a lot of that education and higher education institutions. LinkedIn's the primary place where folks are networking, connecting, joining groups. Follow me on LinkedIn at Andrew Madsen for a data analytics community, right? And a lot of these data analytics and data science, but a lot of these networking things really rose. You know, they definitely existed before COVID, but then COVID hit and everybody went online, and that really skyrocketed these niche communities into global communities. Because before it'd be like the Southern Utah data group would get together and be 50 people show up, right? But then they had to go online. They're like, oh, let's just open up globally. Now 5,000 people show up and it's grown. But now COVID's over and now we're kind of back to in-person. But all these folks are already connected. So now there's just much bigger data conferences, and people have that appetite to go back to conferences and network with folks that they met online that they probably wouldn't have if they hadn't been forced to really network online during COVID. So there's a
lot of the nice things about UX is that because people find UX through a variety of different career paths, the training for UX has been fairly democratized. Like a lot of the big UX consulting firms put out a lot of training videos and a lot of articles for free for the community. And so there's little communities around the big consulting firms like the Nielsen Norman Group, which I alluded to earlier, or Figma, one of the big technologies that UX professionals use, has a community around it, which is really nice. But then there's also UXPA, which is the big national, maybe international, organization that represents UX designers and researchers, offers training, offers conferences. And I think in 2024, there will be a greater demand for that sort of stuff, but maybe not just articles and training videos and even conferences. I imagine that in 2024, or maybe beyond that, we'll start to see more micro-credentials and more formal certifications to give people a leg up in the admissions process, but also the hiring process. If you have a badge of some kind, or if you have some sort of certifiable skill set or expertise, I think that would be very lucrative to whatever organization offers it, but also potentially very helpful for the candidates who are trying to break into the field or level up their skills. I don't know if a lot of organizations have really latched onto that idea yet. So there's your free $1 million idea, listeners. Develop micro-credentials in UX that people are actually persuaded by and value.
Yeah, data has the opposite problem when there's too many micro-credentials. Now that it's flooded and then they hold no weight. But similar to UX, product-based or company-based groups are really good. Like Tableau's a case study for building community with their Tableau user groups, with Tableau Public, and then their Tableau education program. So they get folks onto Tableau early by making it free for educators and students. Power BI has user communities. Alteryx has Alteryx Power Users and a great education program. AWS has really good programs. So it's driven by companies trying to ensure that their products are used and that their users become evangelists for them. And as a result of that, we get lots of great free training and community.
And that leads us into the second point we wanted to cover, Andrew, which was trends in technology. And I'm curious what you'll have to say because data is such a diverse space to work in. It seems like new tools are popping up all the time. What kind of tech trends do you see in the offing?
Well, with data, that there's been a lot of companies and software just popping up everywhere over the last several years. Now, it used to be that you could go to a conference and see kind of who was funded by which VC, and that would really tell you if that company was likely to be around in 5 years, if that product would exist. And that helps me determine really, like, is this a feature or is this a company? Right, like should this just be an add-on to something that already exists, or is this something new and innovative that's going to continue to grow and expand? But now everybody's funded, so everybody has a VC behind them. So the money from VCs is flowing much more freely to grow those companies. So it's tougher to tell which are going to have that resilience and longevity. But because of that, so many companies have grown their data stack to unreasonable sizes and complexity. We all migrated to the cloud because they heard that's what we need to do. So we took all of our on-prem storage and servers, we migrated it to the cloud. But now we're realizing, right, cloud costs super expensive, and folks didn't have a good FinOps, what they call FinOps, managing the costs of your data programs, especially cloud usage. They've got instances idling, which is constantly running up money. Who's doing that? Who left their cloud instance running and then got fired, and then it's just still running while they're not there? So, and now folks are trying to pull back from being 100% cloud. Maybe now they've got some on-prem, maybe they've got some bare metal in addition to their cloud. But in terms of technology, FinOps, so managing costs is definitely going to be a trend, in my opinion. We've seen a pullback in hiring recently in the data world. I've seen a lot of big companies with hiring freezes, and I think they're going to be a lot more cost conscious about their data and technology. So the rise of FinOps is going to be one for sure. There's going to need to be technology to support that. Secondly, I'd say that compliance and regulatory issues are going to need to be managed, and that's going to include data quality, data governance. A lot of these companies grew so fast or created a data stack that they just needed to operationalize, and the data is free flowing. They're thinking, let me build a pipeline, let me get a dashboard on the end of this. How can we make money? How can we be more effective? But then they continue growing and growing without having proper data governance in place. So they've got data all over the place. They don't know where it is, who's accessing it. Do they download it to some Google sheet that's now available on their phone? So data governance, master data management, data catalogs, access management, those kind of solutions, well, will likely also implement AI as part of that to get their data quality up, to auto catalog, auto classify a lot of their data will be incredibly important, especially with, here's my third prediction for technology, the unstructured data. So data lakes and data lake houses are going to be the norm, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of tech trends and user experience as well. I don't know a lot of user experience people who are working specifically on the data governance side. Maybe I'm just not plugged into the right people, although a lot of UX people probably have a great skill set to step into that role. as they continue to grow it within the company. But I'm glad you mentioned AI. I thought, oh my gosh, are we going to get through this whole podcast without mentioning artificial intelligence? I tried to hide from this stuff because, like, I don't want everything I do to be disrupted just yet. I'm having such a good time teaching and doing UX, but it is a force that UX people are going to have to contend with, and from a couple of different angles. On the one hand, AI tools can build your whole prototype if you let it, but should it? I mean, at what point are you going to step in as the designer and double check what's going to be the relationship between human and machine, or designer and user? And so AI is going to streamline a lot of processes, but I think it could also lead to a lot of laziness in design and a lot of potential problems if you outsource too much to the technology. On the other end, I think a lot of UX designers and researchers are going to be asked to, they already are, but I think a growing number are going to be asked to design better artificial intelligence experiences to make the actual experience of using artificial technology even better. And I think the uncanny valley is a useful design principle. I often ask my students, okay, think about the original Star Wars. Which of the droids is way more obnoxious and creepy? R2-D2, who's basically a talking Pepsi can, or C-3PO, who's like this butler sort of thing? And almost without exception, they say, well, C-3PO is way creepier and way more annoying. And the uncanny valley predicts that eventually technology becomes too human-like, like C-3PO, that it starts to become kind of unsettling. You know, we love the beeping Pepsi can in R2-D2, but a lot of people really dislike C-3PO because he's too human-like. And I think that's a design feature that AI builders, users, researchers are going to have to contend with. At what point is AI becoming less like R2-D2 and more like C-3PO, and thus kind of annoying and kind of creepy? But also established technologies that are continuing to evolve, like virtual reality and augmented reality, are going to really become important for UX. Those are the main ones I think I had on my list. AI, VR, AR, both from both in informing the design process and the research process, which will change the role of UX people, but also in making the experiences of artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and augmented reality more pleasant and efficient for the end users.
Yeah, and when you say AI, are you talking generative AI?
Yeah, I was thinking like ChatGPT. It's like, it seems like everyone and their dog nowadays is trying to build a chatbot for different things. I mean, there's a lot of other AI tools as well, but I was thinking specifically things like ChatGPT or different programs that will automate the building of your website after you put in a few parameters, or automate your new mobile application after you kind of specify what you want. And from an instructional standpoint, I think that's really exciting because students can undertake much more ambitious projects. And in industry, people can potentially offer a lot more speed, a lot more efficiency in their design teams. But there has to be oversight, and there still has to be a human element, because we don't want to outsource all of the decisions to the technology.
That's right. Yeah, AI is, I hate when people say AI, because AI is a big, broad category, and AI has been around forever. Machine learning is a subset of AI. Deep learning is a subset of AI. Generative AI, with using transformers, it's really a very niche subset within this big broad category. But yeah, as you say, there's going to be a balance between being lazy and being effective. I just used Figma yesterday to create a product increment planning flow with AI. It just said, what do you want to do? And I said, make me a quarterly product increment plan, incorporate these elements. And it just built the whole board for me in Figma. And I changed very little about it, to be honest. So it's like, that actually made me more effective, because I was able to go in and evaluate, like, is this what I want? But if I didn't know what I was doing, I was like, hey, build me a website. And I didn't know HTML, right? It's like, Okay, it's that now we're lazy because I don't know how to fix it. I don't know how to evaluate the quality of the code that it's showing to me. So it's always balancing, like, is this making me more effective? Because I can gauge the quality and determine is this a good or accurate response or not? Or is it making me lazy and now we've got a quality risk because I don't know how to evaluate it. I don't know the underlying mechanisms, the code, whatever it is. And so I think you're spot on there.
Yeah, so you've alluded a couple times to regulations and ethics. And what sort of additional regulations and ethics issues are you seeing as we approach 2024? As you look into your crystal ball, what are some things we got to watch out for?
Well, I think one that's in progress is the copyright question of whether or not copyrighted material that's used to train LLMs is one legal, and do they owe some kind of funding to these copyrighted materials? Do the LLM companies owe some kind of payment to these copyrighted materials? My prediction is no, unless the LLM company stole the material. They stole it, maybe not, but if it's just out there, right? Like then it's the difference between influence and plagiarism, right? So I predict that the copyright lawsuits don't have a leg to stand on, both in the visual and the large language model space. We've got lots of growing regulations out there specific for privacy rights, both domestically and internationally. California passed CCPA, the augmentation onto, or they passed CPRA, the augmentation onto CCPA, their California Privacy Rights Act, which gives California residents lots of rights regarding knowing where their data is, the right to delete it, the right to opt out of automated decision making. Many states are using that as a template. Colorado's not far behind, Illinois, Connecticut. I'm surprised we haven't seen more right-wing states kind of jumping on board with this, to be honest. New York's here because we want to protect people's data privacy. I think we'll see a lot more of those coming up and getting passed here. And then the federal government will have to do some, should do something, pass some kind of uniform federal privacy right regarding, are they going to set a ceiling? Like this is as high as we want states to regulate. This is as restrictive as we want states to regulate, or a floor where like this is the bare minimum we want states to be able to regulate. So that's still up for debate, and lobbyists are watching that closely. The federal government, just inside baseball, has discussed a lot of these things, and so far they've said that they'll likely propose a ceiling, saying like this is if we propose something, we'll say like this is the maximum amount of regulation that we want states to be able to do. A lot of states aren't happy with that. They're like, we want you to give us a floor and say like here's the baseline of regulation, and we could go on top of that as restrictive as we want. Globally, we've got India just passed a privacy law, which is fantastic for them. So lots of companies do lots of business with India. So complying with that is super important. The EU, of course, has GDPR, but they just passed their AI regulation. So I think we'll see more and more international regulation, not just specific to privacy, but then getting really focused on adding on amendments to like AI. How can automation and AI be used in what processes and how can it be tested? These things all need to be fleshed out, and Europe's pretty quick on the trigger for this, so they'll likely be a litmus test for other areas.
Yeah, and I'm seeing in terms of regulation a little bit more hesitance or a little bit more discomfort with dark patterns. And the state of California really led the way with some of that legislation. It hasn't picked up the momentum that I'd like to see just yet. I believe I was reading just the other day that India has outlawed or has outlawed for a long time drip pricing and other sorts of things that are very common in the United States, but ultimately deceive the user in the other way in various ways. I would love to see more movement on that, although even just defining what a dark pattern is it ever okay? Is it always not okay? Does it depend on industry? There's some very thorny ethical and contextual questions that regulators have to deal with. But my general impression is that the EU has been ahead of North America and other parts of the world for a long time. And so there's probably a need for some comparative studies of regulation to see what has been proposed on a global stage and what have been the outcomes and impacts of these different policies involving data. And I hate to say it, Andrew, but I think that we have at least one major data breach coming up in 2024 because data is becoming, or not, like the new oil, because more people are touching it. Companies are trying to do more with their stuff. Maybe they don't have all the infrastructure built up on the back end. I think that user privacy is going to be more and more of an issue, and that companies really need to hurry to get up to speed so that they can offer their users and their employees data protection and good data governance.
Yeah, I think one trend we'll see is right now, my impression is that most companies are trying to be legally compliant. They're not trying to do more. They're not trying to go above and beyond what they're legally obligated to do. They're not using it as a differentiator yet. But I predict that in 2024, we'll see more companies trying to be the standard of privacy, and then they'll use that as a brand differentiator, saying like, look how good we take care of your data, regardless of what state you live in, regardless of what rights that you legally have available to you, our standards higher. And I think that's going to be a big differentiator. I think it's kind of wait and see right now. A lot going on with regulations. I think, unfortunately, it takes fines, right? It takes findings and fines to make change. And until then, it's like, does this regulation have teeth? Like, what's the risk acceptance? But once somebody gets nailed for something, then everybody looks and says, oh, what did they do? Why did they do it? Let's change. Sephora got nailed last year for data privacy because everybody had kind of interpreted CCPA, CPRA one way in terms of data privacy and the rights that Californians had. Most companies took kind of a loose interpretation of this, but then Sephora got nailed with a big fine, and everybody looked at the finding and read through it, and they're like, oh shoot, and then they buttoned up their programs. So I think we may see some more examples of companies being hauled out in front of everybody and getting a big fine to kind of show everybody what the regulators really expect.
On the UX side of things, one design feature that no one has really figured out is terms of service or terms of use. Because some companies do try to communicate their data policies to their users, but they end up delivering these massive, ugly, inscrutable legal documents. I had some friends who studied terms of use, and they found that some of these things for common products and services were longer than the Shakespearean play Hamlet. And so there's a culture in just the users of digital products to proceed without read, just click, 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 accept. But what exactly did you accept, and what ethical or legal obligation are companies under, or what obligation should they be under to educate their users on how their data is stored, how their data is managed, who's allowed to touch the data, what kind of third parties might access their data? Like, man, terms of use have been a mess for a long time. And in 2024, I think they're going to remain a mess. But if companies really want to do some corporate social responsibility and offer more value to their brand, then find a way to at least clean up terms of use so that your customers know what you're doing on the back end and educate them to know what to expect of other companies as well.
That comes from lawyers, just having helped run the data privacy program at a Fortune 100 firm. And helping create the data privacy policy as required by CPRA, that's a lawyer thing. And try to simplify it, it's not going to get simplified. You give them a proposal, you send it into a group of data privacy and regulation attorneys. You send them 3 pages, it's going to come out 60. And then they're going to go hire a data privacy consulting lawyer who charges $800 an hour, who's then going to add on 7 more pages. It's really risk, in their eyes, risk mitigation, by trying to be opaque in some ways in case how you're handling data on the back end evolves, right? Or you may not have a solid process on the back end. You'll just kind of handle it as it comes up. They handle it That's how it happens. I've seen very few companies have a simple to understand data privacy policy.
But that is an area where regulation can help. At various points in federal history, there have been mandates to write laws, or at least parts of laws, in plain language. And so, with terms of service or just materials about data governance and data usage, it would be super helpful to at least have a plain language summary of what people think they're agreeing to. And that way, companies could ideally get in all of the legalese that they need to maintain their risk mitigation, but also allow users to actually consent to that, to the thing that they're in theory consenting to, letting them have an informed decision before they hit the accept button, fighting proceeding without, well, I'm having a hard time saying this today, having a hard time, oh gosh, I'm trying to say they should not be proceeding without reading, if that makes sense.
Yep, 100%. And I think the best practice is that a seventh grader should be able to read and understand it, but often that's not how it comes out. Well, we've had lively debates with different attorneys and compliance professionals about like what different privacy policies say, but then you go out and you compare it with others in the industry, and it's exactly, they're all the same. They're complicated, they're long, they're hard to understand. So it would be I don't think 2024 is the year to simplify that, but I'll bet 2025, if they nail someone with a fine, we'll see a lot of simplification around policies in terms of use.
I don't know if they still do it, but Apple iOS used to have, you know, their big long terms of service, but they would add little Easter eggs to it, just assuming that their users wouldn't make it that far, so that you'd be reading along. It's like blah 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 blah. Tom smells like pickles up on like room 7, or like I really like candy. They would have like these really weird statements, just assuming that no one would read. But then once word gets out that, oh, the Apple iOS has like these really weird, quirky phases, it provides this kind of strange incentive for people to actually understand how their iPhone works and maybe read part of the terms of service, fishing for these little Easter eggs, these little asides, these little moments of informal language. And so I think that companies could potentially design some nudges like that, maybe gamify the experience a little bit, to educate their users on what to expect from them in terms of data governance and usage.
Yeah, it's all about that friction. They just assume nobody's going to read it. Yeah, excellent. There's a lot coming up in 2024 that I'm excited to see. Are there any general trends that we haven't talked about that you think are going to pop up in 2024?
We've alluded it to a couple different times, but more diversity of data. You know, a lot of times data in certain fields is mostly like text and numbers, but I think especially with the AI tool, oh, sorry, I know you don't like that term, with these tools that may or may not have artificial intelligence involved at some point, generative or not, I think that the ability to analyze things like images and video and stuff like that, or just the size of the data sets that companies are collecting, is potentially going to add real value to products and services or lead to a major data breach. So I think the types of data are going to continue to diversify. And I think the demand for training is going to continue to increase. People who are already in UX and who are already in data analytics, I imagine are trying to upskill to try to keep up with the pace of change, learn new tools, learn new ways of doing things. Traditional tools like usability tests and A/B tests are always going to be a staple of things like UX, but I think that the demand for good training, whether it has a micro-credential or not, is going to continue to increase both in data analytics and in UX.
Yep, I agree. And I think that it's going to augment the different professions, both UX and data, with having copilots working hand in hand, right, with the generative AI, writing code, changing code, right, running analyses together with the AI. I don't think generative AI is going to replace data professionals. I think it's going to augment them. And to your point, I think it's going to increase the ability to upskill. So I've already seen several startups and a couple I'm, for disclosure, working with, who are seeking to upskill data analysts in, for instance, machine learning and building and productionizing different predictive models, clustering. So before, it'd be that you had to hire a data scientist who really understood Python well and understood, how can I use Jenkins to productionize this? How can I measure model drift? Now we've got tools who can kind of do that for you, but you have to understand some of the underlying principles, and it's like an add-on to a data analyst skill set. Now I don't have to go out and hire $200,000 a year data scientist. I can take my $120,000 a year analyst, or whatever it is, $50,000 a year. I don't know where you're at, but I can add on these capabilities by adding some software, some training, some guardrails around it. And now suddenly we've got all these predictive capabilities with minimal friction. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Tons of startups looking to upskill in the data professions.
I would predict too, speaking of companies, continuing or even heightened confusion about what data analytics even is. Because I think a lot of companies hear that, oh yeah, we need data people. We need to do something with our data. But I imagine there's going to be some very ambiguous job titles and some very ambiguous job advertisements. And I think data analysts, data analytics pros know their stuff, but at a lot of companies, I think that their roles and their tasks get a little bit too diluted, and like they get hired ostensibly for doing data analytics, but then they end up doing something else, maybe being more of a managerial role or more of a design role, just because the company doesn't know how to leverage data analytics or understand how it is a full-time position or should be a full-time position. So I would predict, continued or even heightened confusion about what data analytics even is or how companies should use their data. And so in a lot of ways, people in UX and data analytics have to evangelize for themselves and educate their employers, their entire enterprises about what they do, why it's valuable, and where possible, design their own jobs so that they can have a full-time data analytics position and not get their efforts diluted into other things that are valuable to the company, but not necessarily related to the analytics portion.
That makes sense. I'm going the opposite way on this one. We'll see how 2024 goes out. You think increased confusion where the analysts and UX designers need to lobby for themselves. I think it's going to come back just because of the price constriction and consolidation I'm seeing in data land, where businesses are going to take a real hard look at what's the business value we're trying to drive, and they're going to align their data teams to that business value. And if they can't explain the business value that they're driving, they're going to drop those positions. I think data teams, if they can't convey their business value, are in trouble. So they better figure out how they're driving that business value, which is a lot of what you and I focus on as consultants in our consultancy, is what is the business value and how can the data teams drive that and optimize that, or how should they, or how are they in helping them connect with their executive stakeholders and sponsors. But if they can't do it, it's hard economic times right now, and with the hiring freezes, with Meta said this is the era of efficiency. That means layoffs, and you better get your job and doing it real good. They've already had tons of layoffs, right? 2024 had tons of layoffs in data land. I think it's going to be real focused on business value. If you can't convey that, you may not have a job. If you can convey that, you're going to continue to grow and expand and have a successful career.
So see our previous podcast on personas, which will help you communicate your value and your work across the enterprise and within your own team.
Exactly, which brings me to my final prediction: data as a product. It's coming, it has to, because it's focused on driving that business value and optimizing decision-making to reduce time on specific tasks and build out new capabilities for jobs to be done, and ensuring that the business is doing well and is profitable and that data teams are directly linked to that. So data as a product, I think, is going to become the norm rather than an emerging trend.